Hey, welcome to The Screenwriting Life. I'm Meg LaFauve.
And I'm Lorianne McKenna.
We are professional screenwriters. We've worked together as a team and separately. We've worked on studio and indie films, live action and animation, from my work on Inside Out and Captain Marvel.
To my work in Pixar's story department on Up, Brave, and Inside Out. We are here to share our insights on the craft of screenwriting and also the life. How to not only survive the ups and downs, but thrive. We want to help you become the best screenwriter you can be and to reassure you that you are not alone on this journey.
Hi, you guys. Thanks for being with us today. We hope that we are your people because you are ours. You're our peeps, our squad. Committed. We're all committed to each other.
And that's our topic for today, finding your people. So we're going to talk about what does that mean? How do you find them? What do you do once you've found them?
And what that means in your script for your I think we can take that all the way to when you're a writer and who's your character's people? What does that mean?
Yeah.
But first, let's get to our week and what we call adventures in screenwriting. Lorianne, how was your week?
My week was good. Let's see. So last week I talked about putting together a script. And this week I sent it out for notes to a few trusted readers. And I'm starting to get some notes back. And what's great is that the notes are really consistent. And I don't mean like the same notes. I mean that everybody's poking at the same areas of the script. So the notes on like what's wrong or what a solution might be are totally different. But the focus is all on those scenes. So that sort of is reassuring that those are the problem areas. Of course, I haven't gotten all the notes in yet, so we'll see. But what's been happening is I'm trying to resist the urge to jump into the rewrite before I get all the notes because I really do need all the notes. And something interesting is happening in that the response has been positive to what I've written, which is also kind of challenging for me to deal with. So I'm having to figure out how to process that. Love this script, right? I love this script. I love what I wrote, which is actually helping me get the notes at all because I'm able to have confidence in what I've written. And something else that I was able to do with this script was, and I've talked about this before, how I'll just write like a barf draft and then I want to send that out. And I want to be like, here's everybody give me feedback. But the danger is that it's so unformed and raw and that the feedback I get could be, you know, people putting their own ideas about what it could be into it. So yeah. What I did this time was I wrote the barf draft and then I spent some time figuring out what it was and what I wanted it to be and sort of crafting it. And so that when I did send it out, I was very clear about it. So one of the notes I got was in this one particular scene, my main character, it didn't sound like her. Her voice was gone. And I agree with it. But because I know what her voice is and who she is, it wasn't challenging to hear that note. I could agree with it because you're right. But that's because I have a really clear sense of who she is and what I want this script to be. So that's been good and interesting. Another thing that happened is my daughter uses my old computer, so she has Final Draft on it. So she really wanted to learn how to use Final Draft. So I sort of taught her a little bit. And then she wrote a screenplay for like 6 hours one day. And she was like, I have so many great ideas. The ideas just keep flowing. You know, I made her take a bath and she's like, I'm just coming up with such amazing ideas. And she wrote until like a minute before bedtime and I had to pull her
like
away.
Eight? Just to What's give that? People context. She's like eight,
she's
nine?
8 years old. And she's like, Mama, I'm a writer. I'm just a writer. This is, you know, I'm so good at it. And like her confidence and her enthusiasm. And then she's like, what if I have an idea in the middle of the night? So I showed her how to write herself a little note so she could do that. And then the next day she woke up and she started writing. She was writing during music class. She admitted it to me. And I was like, okay, school first, then writing. And then she just wrote all afternoon. I made her take a little break and then she started playing with these storytelling dice that we have where like they have little pictures on them. She's like, this is so inspiring. So I gave her a notebook and she started writing down episode ideas. So part of me is like incredibly proud of her, but part of me is like, oh, great. She's going to win an Oscar way before I am. Like, she's 8 and she's already writing her terrible first screenplay. And she's doing all the things that we say to do, right? Like, send yourself notes when you come up with ideas. Make sure to take breaks. Write down episode ideas. Figure out how to be inspired. Like, she's doing all the things just naturally. She's playing. But it is so, it was so shaming. Because I'm like, I'm not doing those things. I was trying to get her to stop writing to watch a Christmas movie with me. Like, that's where I was. So
okay, but she hasn't gotten notes yet. So she's right now sitting in the pureness of blue sky. I'm the best, confident. This is amazing.
Yes.
Because, you know, she hasn't gotten notes yet.
No.
She hasn't had to think that she sucks yet.
Which, yes, I know.
And hopefully another thing, she won't until she's older. But
yes, I'm not giving her notes. But I did teach her about, like, every character has to want something in the scene, and that's what creates conflict. And at one point she came and she's like, Mama, I've created too much conflict in this scene. I have to take a break. I'm like, oh my God, what's happening?
I love it.
I've created this monster.
No, you've created a confident human, female human,
yes,
who is loving herself and her writing. And what more could we want to do on this planet other than create that to go out into the world and change it? And
yes.
Boy, and then, I'm just amazing.
And then last night she was practicing ukulele and she's like, look, I wrote a whole new song. She wrote the lyrics. She wrote the chords. She came down and performed it for me. I'm like, oh my God, I have got to get my shit together and be more productive.
I love it. There's a great bar being held right in front of you.
Well,
I know. And I also want to talk about, she's so comfortable giving herself praise.
Yes.
She's very comfortable saying, I like this.
Yes.
I think this is great. Whereas you've been learning this week how uncomfortable you are with that and
yes,
having to learn a new muscle, which is accepting praise. Why do you think hearing that people like your writing, which I know you want just like every other writer
yes,
on the planet, we all want that recognition. We all want to know we've been received and people are getting it and liking it or at least moved by it. Why do you think you're uncomfortable with it?
I think because, you know, I so desperately want validation and praise and love and all those things that when you get compliments, what that means. And when I am getting it, I feel like if I really feel it, then it makes me want to cry. Because at the same time, I'm sort of grieving that I didn't get that, enough of that, either when I was growing up or in my writing or something that it connects to some pain I have about whether it actually is true that I didn't get enough of that or
it doesn't matter.
Yeah. So it connects to some pain that, you know, it's just another, you know, emotional thing I have to deal with. Right. So it's like, it's better just to be like, I reject your compliment, you know, I think it's that.
But here's the thing. I do think that your writing will get even better, and you know how much I love what you just wrote, when you take the time to sit in that grief and let it be, because it's frozen right now inside of you. It hasn't done what it needs to do, which all of these things want to move through you to open you up and teach you and help you, you know, feel and be in the world. And if they can't do that, they just get frozen and locked away. And then your being is taking a lot of energy to keep that frozen instead of allowing it out into the work.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you can just allow that grief to speak, put it in a character if that's safer, right?
Yeah.
But I do think it would be worth, since it's up and walking around, because sometimes it's even hard to access it later. Like, it's up and walking around because you got good praise. So it's been triggered. The door's open. So you're looking at me right now on the Zoom like over my, I'm not doing
it. No. I was thinking, yes, I totally agree with you. And I was thinking how hard that's going to be. And part of that is as a woman, right? Like, I've worked so hard with my daughter to like give her praise, to help her and encourage her to talk about herself in a positive way. And I've had to model that. And it is excruciating, right? To say to her, like, I'm a good writer, because I need her to hear me say that so that she can own her
and model,
positive aspects.
Yeah.
And I think it's just hard, you know, as a woman too, being out in the world and saying, I believe in myself. I wrote a good script. I believe in this. And part of that is
because we're taught that that's arrogant and selfish and that we need to constantly undercut ourselves.
Yes.
Which really, I'm sorry, that goes back to patriarchy. And that's a way that that the power structure keeps itself in power because mm-hmm. it tells you that the way you get validation is to undercut yourself. So,
yes.
And I know you know all that. I'm just saying it for
But that's a loud, part of it, too. So there's like a personal struggle. There's a power struggle with culture and the patriarchy. So it's layered. And I'm sure men struggle with this as well. I don't think this is unique, but it's part of my struggle. But so, you know, I'm trying to. But part of it that's helping is that I also love this script and I know it's good because it's the truth. So it's really it feels sort of empowering to get feedback. Of course, then I'm already thinking ahead to the next one. Like, will it be any good? You know,
No, don't go there. No. That door you should close. Just close that door. Open the other one and close that one. That is not going to help you at all.
But I did.
Am I allowed to say proud of you? That might be sound condescending. I don't mean that. I just mean as your friend, I'm just so proud that you did that barf draft and you went into the lava and you sat in it. And then, you know, instead of wanting to send it out, you did that hard work, that next step of getting some objectivity, looking at it, which is going back into the lava in the own way, in a different way. And really, I just, and I'm not surprised that it's as good as it is because I do know that about you. Oh, I know what a good writer you are. And I'm just so excited.
I mean, honestly, I'm proud of myself too. Like, that's a little hard to admit too. Like, I didn't fight it that hard. I'm like, okay, I have to sit with this, right? If I want this to be something that isn't just, you know, the barf draft. Like, and also, I feel like that is, I'm not respecting my readers as much when I send them a barf draft. I'm asking a lot more of them, help me shape this. Tell me what this is. Give me guidance, give me advice, and I'm not presenting my best work. And for me, you know, even where I am in my career, it still felt like a big leap, you know, and I'm sure there's probably a lot of writers that have already blasted through this piece of it, but for whatever reason, it's just where I am this week, what's happening now.
And I think that it's funny when we talk about having your people. There might be, if you're at a place in as a writer in your development that you actually do need that help at the barf draft, there will be people, and we'll talk about it in a minute, who you can have do that with you, who understand it's a barf draft, who understand the support kind of support you need, who will be good at asking you the questions versus telling you what it is. And then I think you do evolve as a writer, and then you do need to take responsibility for that next step where you are, Lorian, which is, no, I'm just kind of, I don't need that out. I don't need that. Like, instead of that being true support, that's become possibly a way to get other people to do it for me. Not in terms of a laziness, but in terms of a maybe reluctance to make those commitments or whatever reason it could be. There's probably many, many reasons that people want that kind of immediate input on the barf draft. But wherever you are as a writer, it's, again, just about self-knowledge and being honest with yourself of, no, right now I do need that barf draft to go to very select people. We're going to talk about that.
Yeah.
Or no, I need to kind of, like you said, I love it, own it, and be confident enough to say, this is what I like, this is what I think it should be, and I'm going to try this. So I just think that's awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, the other week,
the last thing about my week is that I am in negotiations right now for a deal. I can't get into the details, of course, but I will say that this process is frustrating for anyone in a deal looking forward to the part where you're negotiating. It is complicated and frustrating and exciting, right? But I still don't feel like I can put all my eggs in that basket, right?
Yeah.
I still feel like I have to be like, what, you know, preparing and planning. So
You do. And because even when that goes, you still have to have the other pots boiling because who knows if the show actually goes or, you know, and it takes so long to get something actually sold and the deal done and the money, the check cut, you know. We're going to have a manager on who's going to answer a lot of your manager questions or representation questions. Mm-hmm. And I think we should talk to him about the deal making. He's done it, you know, for so many years. So we'll definitely get into that. We can bring a lawyer on if you guys want. Tell us on the Facebook page. And if that's something you know, tell us how deep you want us to go into this kind of negotiation and that kind of stuff.
So Meg, how was your week?
How was my week? My adventure this week. Well, just yesterday, last night at 5:00, which so it's fresh in my mind, I had a note session, which was great, which I have to just express that some they're not always fuck you, fuck me, what's next. That's not always how they are. Now, to, you know, context, this is the quote unquote official second draft going into the producers to get their insights before it goes to the buyer. So, you know, we've been on this for literally years. I mean, I think we pitched our take on this source material 2 years ago. So I hopefully should be at the point where the note session is good. And it's literally like, just tweak here and do here, right? Like after like 2+ years of working on this story, I thank God we earned this. But it was good because, not just because there weren't very many, but really because the executive had a really good insight. Kind of what you were saying, Lorian, where I'm so certain of this now that when she says, I need more here from the character, I don't actually know what she's feeling, which part of me is like, ah, what do you mean you don't know? Yeah. But I'm like, okay, you know what? You're right. I totally glossed over that. I got to slow down here. I tend in my descriptions to be very sparse. Mm-hmm. I want the dialogue, the behavior of the character, the choices the character are making, what's happening in the scene to tell you the emotion. I really do. But that's one of my small fallbacks is I sometimes don't give them enough. I have to give mm-hmm. them slightly more in the description. I just hate those phrases like, you know, a tear in the corner of her eye. I'm like, I hate that. I don't know why. I don't know if it's because I used to be an assistant and read so many scripts that it's gotten banged into my head that mm-hmm. like, that's hacky, whatever. So I have to get over that and really find ways to, in the description, help them understand the context of the emotion that I'm trying to get to here. I think I might go read a Richard LeGravenet's script. I'm sure he did it beautifully on the page, you know, that master of character. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so that was great. It was great
That's
to
great.
Get notes.
Congratulations.
That I agreed with. And, you know, always remember that executives have been doing this a long time and they can be and are often very insightful and really trying to help you get the best, version across. And the other, you know, and it also related to two questions we got on the Gmail account about doing rewrites that I just wanted to bring up real quick. One was, you know, do you have to do all the notes? And the answer is no, you don't. You're getting notes as feedback, but really all the notes that you get are about what they're telling you what they didn't get. Mm-hmm. That's what they're telling you. And maybe other people did get it. Maybe this person read it fast. Or you have to assess the notes and look for the note under the note and all that stuff we talked about. The other question was about, how do you know if you've changed enough? Well, honestly, the way is you get another read from more people who haven't ever read it before. Don't go keep going back to the same well over and over because now they know it. Mm-hmm. And so they're reading in and they've had the discussion with you. You got to have fresh people read it. I don't even care if that's just your mom, your aunt, your uncle. Like, they should be able, and it's harder for lay people to read scripts. I understand that. But, you got to get fresh perspective to see now are they getting it. And, you know, I still think, have you gone to the deepest problem? I'm going to say it a million times. You take all those notes, but look for the deepest, biggest core problem, and then half of them, if not more, will go away. The other thing I did was yesterday or today, I can't remember now already, I got my new Academy Gold mentee was assigned to me, and I just wanted to talk about that, you know, I really love so much mentorship. AFI has asked me to mentor somebody. These aren't huge mentorships like every week or anything like that. It's literally like, well, you talk to them twice over the next 6 months. I generally do a lot more than that because I get involved. But it's interesting because as much as this is an important value to me, I also have to start learning to put up boundaries. Mm-hmm. Because I am like, first of all, I'm not writing what they're writing. I am not their parent. I am not their teacher even. I am a mentor. And, you know, I have to be clear, and it's not that anybody has ever crossed that boundary on the other side. It's more me.
Right.
I'm like, I want to help you so much that I just, and what happens is it takes time away from my work.
Right.
And again, this is this kind of female thing that your value is how much you help others. And it's learning to say, nope, that's good. You're good. Because by the way, like how arrogant of me, like I'm going to be their only mentor in their life. Like there's plenty of other people that can help them, right? Like I don't need to take the responsibility of this person's life on. And then it made me think of something I wanted to bring up today before I forgot that as much as the opposite can be true. I don't necessarily for mentors, but for teachers. Like I have met people, writers and not writers and other artists, not even in writing, who become almost addicted to finding teachers. And what happens is, and listen, I come from a long line of teachers, many, many generations of teachers. I love teaching. It is a very core, passionate part of me. But from the other side, you can get addicted to the teaching because you're not doing the work. Like there is a beautiful, lovely comfort in being taught, right? Which I love. But if it is not teaching towards doing the work, towards self-discovery, towards the lava, towards the pain and suffering and beauty of being the creator, then you have to actually see if maybe you're addicted to it.
Interesting.
Right? Because as long as you have a teacher, you're in the child position. And I think that, again, beautiful thing, but creators are not in the child position. They are in the ownership position. They are in the, this is what I think, this is what I want to do. And you do have to make that jump. And it doesn't have to be like overnight, but just, it's again, it's all about awareness and to kind of think about it as you are thinking about it. And then in terms of my own writing, I totally got stuck in Act One, which I have to admit, I'm supposed to be doing a barf draft and I cannot get out of Act One. I think I've rewritten it like, eight times. I don't even know how many times because I rewrote the beginning four pages, like 16 times. And I was like, oh my God, I'm like out here preaching barf drafts and I'm stuck in Act One. And I was like, okay, why am I stuck here? Like, just know myself. What's going on, Meg? What's happening? I'm like, okay, first of all, I'm getting to know the characters. They're walking and talking and taking on a life of their own and it's shifting. And I think that on this particular project, I've gotten so much input already. There have been so many versions of the outline. There's so much stuff to put in that this Act One is a pruning. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, well, I love that we had this idea to put me and the director or whoever the hell gave it to us to put this moment in. But, like, what does it mean to the whole thing? Like, I have to prune that out because I kind of have to clear it out. I have to clear out all those outlines, which I know sounds crazy because I do want you to do cards and outlines if that helps you. But when you go to draft, sometimes it can get cluttery in your brain, right? Because sure, in the outline, it looked like that was going to be 20 pages, but guess what? It's 45. Like, right. Oh my God, it's 45 pages. Now, a true barf draft, you would not stop. You would realize, oh my God, I'm supposed to, this should be 20 and I'm on 45. Oh, well, it's a barf draft. It's called barf for a reason. So really keep going. But because I'm in relationship with a director and a producer and a giant team, it's much harder for me to do that because I have to be like, oh, I am dramatically making big path road choices here. So I better get him involved in the puking. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've got to be like, do you want to go right or left? Because I can tell you if we go right, it's going to go this direction or left direction. Now, I do think that my director would be fine if I just made those choices as an artist and brought it back to him. But I don't, it's just not what I want to do. So, you know, I puke drafts when you're working really intimately with a director or a team are a little bit trickier. And I just wanted to acknowledge that. And I also, in the Gmail, somebody talked about working with a manager very, very closely, doing every single beat step of an outline of what the draft she's going to write. And I think that's great. And she's feeling great. And it was a very positive email and I was really happy to hear her getting this great feedback. But then my immediate thought was, and it could all change. Like in a genre, it's a little easier because if it's a super high genre horror, or then really that what that manager or person who's doing the intimate work with you is, they're literally kind of putting down the big stones probably of the genre, hopefully, right? And they know it very well. And those might not change because the genres have generally certain things. But really, honestly, even that, you could write your barf draft. You have done 8 outlines. You have done it intimately and it goes freaking left and thought you were going right. And you know what? That's what happens. And maybe you're going to barf it out and you're going to come back and be like, I needed to go left to grab this piece and bring it back and go right again. So don't panic. I say, as the person who started to panic, just know, just keep barfing it out. And if you're working with a director, just know it's a little more complex and you have to have conversations with that person to let them know what's going on. And, you know, so that's, I just wanted, I've been going through this and beating myself up about it, honestly. So I just wanted to share it with you guys in terms of understanding.
It seems like what you're doing, though, on that project is not actually a barf draft because you've been doing so many other note sessions and other process work. I mean,
yeah, it's, there's a lot of cooks in that kitchen, and not in a bad way, in a great way. I feel very lucky, but yeah, it doesn't feel like a barf draft. It literally feels like, okay, write this outline that has been approved and gone through I don't even know how many versions. And so when it starts to not do that, I'm like, oh, wait a minute, right? If you were on a TV show, you can go through this kind of process and have this many people. And if you're sent off to write the episode, it's not really a barf draft because you have to follow what was broken in the room.
Yeah.
And if you're not following it, you got to quick go to the person above you and be like, I have this gut feeling it's going this direction, and then see how well they take that.
Right.
You know, it's just really understand, you know, that the when you're a pro and this kind of barf draft, it gets a little bit, they're not really, you're right, Lauren, it's not really a barf draft.
Like mine was a barf draft because it's an original spec. So I just barfed out everything based on the outline I wrote, cut most of it, wrote it, as I was shaping it. But when you're working with someone else, you know, professionally, getting paid for it with more structure, it feels like it's something else. Right, you're
and I felt like a lot of the barfing happened. This is so funny. A lot of the barfing happened when I did those millions of outlines, right? Like, so much of that is just pulling up clay, right? I mean, it's still great. I mean, every time I've rewritten this first act, I have learned something more interesting and more nuanced. And so I'm very happy about it. It's just much slower. I oddly pride myself on how fast I can go. And it's I'm not going that fast. I feel this crazy dumb pressure. So that was my week. So Jeff, how was your week?
You know, I in terms of writing, I feel like I missed out a little bit this week. I feel like I have, like, the production day jobs that we talk about have really been all consuming lately. And it's, you know, I always think about the conversations we have about shadow artistry, and it's good. It's challenged me in really healthy ways. And I think I mentioned, I'm going to be directing something this summer and teaching a class around it, which is great, but I have a proposal due for that, and I've kind of been putting it off. So I'm excited this weekend to get into it, and you know, I don't want to self-sabotage, like we talk about a lot on this show, because I'm afraid of an amazing opportunity. So I've been challenging myself in really good ways, and I know this weekend I'm going to get into it.
Do you need a deadline from us?
Maybe. You know what? Next time we meet, this proposal has to be done.
It has to be done. Next show, it has to be done.
All right.
And it will
be. And by the way, that's probably multiple drafts done. Think about that. Like, it's not just a proposal that you're going to barf out and then hand to somebody. It's a proposal. You have to rewrite it.
You're going to have to put together a little production schedule for yourself on how you're going to get there.
I know. I think tomorrow's really going to be the day, so it might mean not baking, which I've loved doing on Saturday mornings.
No baking. But I'm saying it right now, no baking.
Okay.
I'm very happy, but that's sabotage. I would love
to
eat it, but eat the bread. But no, no baking. You have to bake your proposal, please.
Perfect.
Let my 8-year-old be an inspiration to you.
I love it. Well, I'm going to speak about other inspirations, and of course, that's our audience. You guys continue to write us in amazing reviews. I'm actually going to throw it back a little bit to Erica O'Harica, which I love that username. I'm
so
guessing
good.
Your name is Erica O'Hara, and you changed it to Erica O'Harica, which I could say that over and over again. It's just that rolls right off the tongue.
It's a great name.
She says, two great coaches when you need them most. First, let me just say, I love this podcast with all my heart. The advice, encouragement, commiseration, and insight Meg and Lorian offer up every Friday is genuine. This is an old review, so that's why it says Friday. Of course, now it's Sundays that you guys get this. But the advice, encouragement, commiseration, and insight Meg and Lorian offer up every week is genuine, engaging, and smart. Like, really smart. So I always feel like I'm learning something valuable and applicable from them. That said, this podcast is also important to my writing process on a purely motivational level. I'm mostly a film director, but there are certain projects that I find I need to write myself. And for me, the act of writing can feel unbridled and scary. There are so many potential directions in which a story could go. And I sometimes need to just listen to someone talk about their approach to the craft to get the courage to face that story again. By sharing their challenges and triumphs as writers, Meg and Lorian help me step back up to the page when I feel lost or defeated or confused. All those things that storytelling does to you, and I'm so grateful for that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So as always, thank you so much. And remember, join that Facebook group if you haven't. The Facebook page and the Facebook group are different. The Facebook group is where you want to be. So if you land on the page, make sure you also subscribe to the group because that's where the action happens. And our email address, if you want to reach us, is thescreenwritinglife@gmail.com. So we created this show to create community. And the more we can continue to do that, the happier we are. So we love you guys and we do it for you.
Yeah, the Facebook group is really doing some great things. They're forming pods to help each other, and it's amazing. And there's some pro writers on there who are also answering questions when Lorian and I haven't, or even when we do. Like, let's get all the perspectives we can for you guys on your questions. You know, some of them I was like, I have no idea. Like, somebody asked about the 8-section structure, and I was like, I have no idea. I've never heard of that. But somebody else had, and they jumped in, and we're talking about it. And so I think that's it's a really awesome place to be because, it, you know, that is all about community. And Lorian and I are very big on creating community. We created a community at Pixar. We created a community together, and we created a community of working parents that we love. And, you know, we just, it's a very big value for us. And I think part of that community creating is finding your people, right? It's the Facebook group for us is our people. You are all our people. We want to create and help you find your people on that page. So you don't feel alone, and you know, it really can be what finding your people does. So Lorian, as our topic, finding your people, what does that mean to you?
I think, for me to start, it's that, basically, one person or even several people can't be everything to you. So it's important to figure out what else you need. So like I have, you know, my husband, my daughter, my family, and they all provide support to me in different ways, but I also really need to have relationships with people who are writers and who understand that. And my husband is always super supportive. He can't stand it when I talk to him about a script, though, because it might change. And that's not the kind of people I need when I'm talking about my writing. I need someone who understands the development process, right? So for me, a big part of that is figuring out and articulating what I need and being open to that. And, you know, a couple years ago, Meg, you were helping me find my beacon. What the hell did I want to do? What did I want to be when I was a grown-up writer? And you helped me do some exercises, and you were like, what else do you need? And I said, I need a group. I need a small group that supports this, that is also doing the same thing. So you went out and put together a small group of other people. And, you know,
we called it the beacon group.
We called it the beacon group. And it was,
I happen to know other people who also were struggling with what's their beacon. And, and by that, I mean, you know, when I, was moving from being a producer to a writer, I decided in my crazy head that I was going to just work right at Pixar, that was the scariest, most exciting place to write, because I thought they were doing some of the best storytelling in the world. I learned about the Brain Trust Room, and that Brain Trust Room became my beacon. I'm going to sit at that table. And, you know, it was a light out on the water on Horizon Line. And you never get to your beacon ABC. It's always like A, D, Z, F. Like, you have no idea why you're going in the direction you're going, and that's fine. And by the way, you can change your beacon as you get towards it and realize, no, that's not what I want. I want to do this. That's fine. But I like having something I'm working towards to keep my boat pointed towards, so that as opportunities come up, I can say, is that going to help me get to the beacon? Like, for example, is baking bread going to help you get to your beacon?
Called out.
Or, you know, and maybe, by the way, there might be a day that baking bread absolutely is, because you're exhausted, you're tired, and you need a break, and you're overworking yourself and frying yourself. So no judgment on anything that anybody's choice is, but I found the beacon helped me get there. So, and it's funny because after I was done with Pixar, I was like, oh my God, what's my beacon? I was like, shit, what am I doing? And it's funny because I it keeps changing on me. But yeah, we had Lori and I talked through that. And then we went and I found some other friends. So I don't think you knew all of them even at the time.
No.
And who were also trying to figure out the same thing. Well, what is my best day if I woke up? What would I be doing? Who would I be? How would I be spending my life energy? Mm-hmm. They all had that same question.
Mm-hmm. And it was this sort of constructed group of people that mm-hmm. was really helpful because there was a sort of, because we all knew you and we were connected to you, there was a sense of trust and intimacy sort of established. And everyone in the group had a different skill set in terms of sharing and vulnerability and wanting to or not. But, you know, it was a great group for a while. Right. And
everybody wasn't screenwriters either. There were novelists that, you know,
we were all creative. We were all creative.
Yeah.
And we all connected in different ways. And over the years, it has sort of morphed, right? It evolved. The relationships evolved. And the need for the group isn't as urgent for some of us, which I think is also an important part of your peopling, right? As you're figuring out how to find that group. And, of course, I have other groups, too. I think, you know, we've talked about networking before and how that's not, you know, sharing business cards and what can I do for you and what can you do for me. It really is about true relationships, really liking someone, respecting someone, wanting to get to know someone. And I think that's the base of finding your people, connecting with someone else who gets you, who you get, who you want to talk to, who understands what you're trying to do, who supports you, but also challenges you a little bit.
Yes, not the best just, people do challenge you and call you on your stuff or say, don't bake.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, you know, when I met you, Meg, I was, you know, working at Pixar. It was great. And you really challenged me. You know, you didn't let me sort of do the thing which I'm so good at, which is distract, tell a story. I'm so funny. Look over here. You were like, no, let's talk about why you're not writing. And honestly, you've been doing that for me for, you know, the whole time we've been friends. And it's amazing. And sometimes I cry and sometimes I get mad, but I know I need it. And for you, for me, you're such a part of my people, you know.
No, and it's the same, and it's a back and forth, right? Like,
yeah.
I would never be able to continue doing that if I wasn't also receiving the same support from you. In the same way of writing, but also just, you know, when I'm walking around CVS crying, trying to see if nobody notices because I've had been so traumatized by something that happened at work. This is not at Pixar. This is much later. Like, literally, I called you and I was like, oh, my God, what do I do? Did this happen? Is this person gaslighting me? I think this happened. And you were able to help me by asking me questions, walk it through. And then the best part was you made me laugh. And just it just changed the calibration of my brain to look at it differently and let it go. And, you know, so much of the support that you can get can also be not helping you not see the drama, but the fun of it. And just, you know, this is just a moment in time. And now I can look back on that traumatic moment at CVS and laugh because you made me laugh. Right. And you do. So, you know, the support can be with writing and craft, and that might be a certain group. Mm-hmm. It might be emotionally in terms of, or it might be career-wise beacon. It might be emotionally like, holy shit, this is hard. And I'm evolving myself and I need someone to talk about that. I don't like, praise. I need to talk about this, right? And that person can be like, why do you think you don't like praise? Or whatever. And now that might be all in the same person, and I'm lucky enough to have Lorian and that all three of those are in the same person. It doesn't have to be, right?
Right.
Not everybody's good at everything. The other thing I would say about it is you do need to nurture your people, mm-hmm. and because it can't be a one-way street, you know? What are you giving back to the group? What are you, you know, I often find myself being the person who is like, we haven't seen each other in a long time because I have all these different groups of community. And every once in a while I'll be like, oh my gosh, I have not seen those ladies in way too long. Like the ladies that I met when I was 20 years old and showed up in LA and we still our friends, and but we're busy now. We have kids, and sometimes our kids are different sexes, which I know sounds crazy, but you guys have girls and I have boys. Mm-hmm. So they're off doing thing with their girls and I'm not, because I don't have a girl. And that can, in a weird way, suddenly I'm like, oh my God, are you not my people anymore? No, of course. They just are, they're going to have other experiences, right? Because we're evolving. My people have been evolving over 25 years, some of these groups. Yeah. And they shift and change. And but always I want to go out and have the drink or do the Zoom, or because I need to check in with them. And mm-hmm. I need to nurture that. They can't, those things can fray and move off. And I like to nurture and come back, even if it's just a touchstone every once in a while. But really, in terms of writing, it is having that support group for you when you need the motivation, when you need to see, you know, not be self-sabotaging, when you need craft questions, like, does this suck? Like, right. I do think it's good to have one or two people who you can give a barf draft to, who yeah. won't judge you, who understand what a barf draft is, and who really aren't going to tell you what to do with it, because it's a barf draft, man. That is not appropriate. They're really going to just ask questions, say, I didn't get this, right? It's a delicate thing to bring somebody into a barf draft and make sure you don't self-sabotage by bringing in a person who's not, should not be in that community, yeah. either because they're in a different community and therefore when you're up further in the drafts, or by the way, I also want to say to you guys, make sure the people you have around you, because you could unconsciously be sabotaging yourself by having people around you in your group, in your squad, who really are there and they're putting you down and they're being passive aggressive and they're undercutting and they're always talking about themselves when you try to talk about yourself. And what they're, you know, there are, and I think a lot of people are unwittingly doing this, but there are succubus in the world. Like they are people who get their life energy from you, right? And you have to be very careful about who you allow into your sacred squad, mm-hmm. who you allow into your sacred group, especially about your writing. Holy yeah. smokes, right? But any group that you have, any people in your life, you do need to ask yourself, why is that person in my life? And yeah. maybe they're in your life because at some point in your life, they did give you something, but you've outgrown them. That's a very innocent, normal thing. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's because you're self-sabotaging. Maybe it's because this is the way that you will never have to accomplish something and go stand in the light, right? And it can all be unconscious. Or maybe unconsciously, this person is marrying one of your parents.
Yeah. Yeah.
And oddly, you feel comfortable in it because you know it. You know how passive aggressiveness works. And it's a weird
comfort.
Psychological comfort yeah. to have that person in your life. And I just want to say to you, what are you giving for that comfort? Yeah. You know, it will affect your writing. And I'd rather, if you can't break up with them, that's fine. Totally fine. I get it. Maybe you're not ready. But maybe take it to your writing and ask why. Let that person live as a character and break up with them on the page and just see what happens, right? So, you know, there can be people you, and, you know, sometimes you let these people in because they had a false face.
Yeah.
You know, this might be in that you thought you let them into the group and you're like, oh, wait a minute. You are not here for sacred good reasons. And then, you know, now here comes the hard thing, especially for women. Oh my gosh, you have to say no.
Right.
You have to say that this is not, I mean, this has very rarely happened to me in my life, honestly. I mean, I don't know if I'm a good judge of character or I've just been lucky, but I've very rarely had to break up with a people in the group. But sometimes you do. And you know what? It's not that you're being mean. And women are so taught to be nice and to be giving and to worry about that person. And here's what I'm going to say. I heard this great thing. I think it might have been Sharon Salzberg, but I'm not sure, who talked about she was on her way in India to go see a famous guru. And on the way, she got mugged. And this person jumped on her rickshaw and tried to grab her purse. And she had a tussle. And so she went to her guru and she was like, what was the great, holy, Zen, enlightened thing to do? Right? What was I supposed to do? And he said, take your stick and hit him on the head. And she was like, what? And he was like, that person needed to be hit on the head. It would have been an act of kindness to try to wake them up with your boundary, right? So sometimes niceness kills people. Like, yeah. You don't have to nice yourself with your people into, it's not good for them. They need someone to say, you know what, nope. You know, this doesn't seem to be a good fit or whatever, right? So your people are your choice.
Yes.
Everybody in your life, you are all adults. Everybody in your life is your choice. Obviously, if you're a parent, no, but we love our kids. So even when they're teenagers, we love them and totally enjoy them. The peopling, you can sabotage yourself with it too. Yeah. So I did want to bring that up, that, and maybe one of the people in your group, as you're diving into your lava, you know, lava can bring up trauma. It can. And I wanted to say, maybe you need to, have a therapist.
Mm-hmm. Therapists can be great people.
They can be great people. Yeah. And I was working with a writer recently, and what she was bringing up was very, very serious and traumatic. It happened years and years ago, so I wasn't worried about it in the moment. But I was like, I think if you're going to do this and you're going down this road, which I so want you to, because there's so much juice in here as a writer, not to sound heartless, but oh my God, this is so good. But you bet, I think you should get a therapist and just have that on the side so that you have that support, mm-hmm. right? That it's really good people to have if you need it. Yeah. And if you don't, you don't. But sometimes you can't ask your people to be your therapist. How many put it that way? Right?
Yes.
They're not trained. They don't have the capability. And it's too much responsibility to ask your people, your squad, to also be a therapist. They don't have that, mm-hmm. unless they are therapists, I guess. They generally don't have that skill set. So it's better, I think, for them and you to get that insight.
And different places you can meet people, right? I've been a mentor at CineStory, and one of the writers that I, well, several of the writers that were my mentees, I've become really good friends with, but one of them has become one of my people, right?
Like, oh, awesome.
We meet every Thursday at 1 o'clock and share work back and forth, and we're really good friends. And so, you know, it's an unexpected, you know, sometimes it's just unexpected.
I was thinking about that, where we could tell people to find their people. I mean, I know the Austin Film Festival is mm-hmm. literally like 3,000 writers finding their people, like like walking through, and I know we can't do it right now, but it'll come back, you know, like walking through the lobby of that hotel and all those groups and pods of writers, and they're meeting, they see each other once a year, and then they talk on the phone and they read each other's stuff and they're drinking and having fun or not drinking, or it was really so exciting and fun how many people from all over the world and were finding each other. It was the same with ScreenCraft. You just felt people, they come every year, or they now saw each other, that they were brand new and didn't know anybody. And yet it's odd. Those writing conferences, writers are lovely people. They're just like, hi. Like we're all the weirdo kids. So we're just very like lovely to meet each other. I thought that was great. You know, the Meryl Streep lab that I did, anytime you can get into a lab, mm-hmm. that's a very bonding experience. They are definitely close to your people because they are also at the lab. And, you know, I do think like the Facebook group, mm-hmm. Facebook, some of those groups, some of those people have become my people. You know, that group that you and I are in, Lorian, there's people that I have never physically met, but I consider them my people now.
Yes.
And some of them are not even in this country, and it doesn't matter because they support us in about parenting, and that it's mm-hmm. great to have a place to go to talk about that. So it can, especially now with Zoom, you know, and the mm-hmm. silver lining of this pandemic is we're creating community now remotely. So mm-hmm. people all over the country, you the writers who are listening all over the country and all over the world, are becoming community, right? Which is so exciting.
I think to jump on what you were talking about before, about how to test if someone is not your people, like mm-hmm. really check in with yourself about why you might be feeling bad after you've spent some time with that person or those people. Right. See if it's the right group. Are you feeling bad because you feel shame or threatened, or does that particular person and how they act toward you make you feel bad? And maybe that's not your person, you know, and you get to investigate all those reasons why. Yeah. But I've had to let go of some people because they just made me feel bad. And it wasn't the kind of reason where I'm being challenged in a productive way. It wasn't you, Meg, challenging me because you wanted me to be a better writer. You wanted me to get my shit together. It was because they wanted to feel better than I was.
Yeah, that's not good.
And so the competition stuff is just, you know, it's just that we have enough of that. Like, you want to have really sort of intimate trust with somebody that they're going to celebrate you when you do amazing things, and that they're going to commiserate with you when something doesn't go your way, and that they're going to help you and you're going to help them.
And I would say that was one of the the 10 top moments of my life. Was I was going to go to the Academy Awards, and I'm going to get choked up. You know, my people came, my 6-8 friends who had been there since the day I said, you guys, I think I want to write. I think I'm going to quit my job and I'm going to write. And they were the ones saying, do it. And they were the ones reading my crappy novel and, you know, reading the drafts or just helping me keep going and all the questions and problems I had. And they were there to just be sounding boards. And they came and they helped me get dressed and we had champagne, and it was so moving to have them along the journey with me. And I think of it because what you said, they were so happy for me. There was no weirdness there about mm-hmm. jealousy, or there was none of that. It was wholehearted, so, so happy. I mean, it's funny where when you gave me your script, I joked. I was like, okay, well, I'm a hack because this is so good. Right? Because, you know, there can be moments even with your best people that you're like, oh my God, she's so good. I'm a hack. But of course, I'm just so happy. I'm so happy about your script. And, you know, our other friend, Amanda, who's this amazing novelist, she is going to win the Man Booker Prize or something because she's just so good.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just am so excited. You know, those are the people that you want who are equally excited for you. You know, so talking about, you know, let's take this also over to writing and creating characters. You know, you can ask yourself, if it helps dig some stuff up, you know, who is your character's people? Who is their community? How did it form before this movie started? What's it based on? Is it healthy? Is it not healthy? Is that, you know, is that community or people around them good for them? You know, what are the belief systems and values of that community they're in? Now, that can be the larger community, i.e. they live in Idaho community, or it could literally be their people. Like, who have they surrounded themselves with? Is that by choice? Well, it is, because whether they know it or not, do they think it's by choice? You know, and often people are, I can't tell you how many scripts I've read that people are like, well, they're isolated. And I'm like, you know, maybe, but that's a pretty big thing to say that this person has no people, not even one, right? And, you know, there's a difference between isolated internally, loneliness, and isolation. You can be around a lot of people, and you can have a lot of quote-unquote squad members around and still be lonely and isolated, and that's a really important moment for your character to realize.
Totally.
That this life I built or this squad I built isn't servicing me anymore, or I'm not this person, or this is all fake, or whatever, right? You know, part of the people around them and their squad will be the authority figures either in that squad or against that squad, or like who, you know, where, what are their opinions about those authority figures? You know, because then in Act Two, are they going to get new people? Mm-hmm. Are they going to get a new squad? Or are they fighting for their squad in Act One? Or has their squad gone with them into Act Two, right? You know, because Act Two going to test that squad, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely going to test your main character. But how is relationships forming? Dory becomes Marlin's people.
Part of that the family.
But you know, it's his people. Like, she becomes his people, and it is a way to look at. And you know, there's a risk to reaching out and opening yourself up to possibly have a person become your people, enter another squad feels risky, right? You have to open your heart and become vulnerable to that, that's part of it.
That's Carl's journey, right? Isolated himself, right? And then Russell becomes his people. And he fights against it, and then he embraces it.
And the dog becomes his people.
And the bird,
The bird. So, you know, and how, or how does your character see their, see people and their community differently at the end? Mm-hmm. Has it changed? Has it remained the same? And that some, maybe something else actually changed in them. But so many movies are about this, if you really look at them, in terms of the shift in who are the people around me and how is that, the most important thing is, how is that reflecting your main character and their journey, right? Yeah. You're peopling the people around them because they're going through a transformation, and these are the people, not knowingly, not consciously, but you know, as the Zeus of the story, this person is here to teach them something. And, you know, your people in real life around you are also here to have perspective and insight for you. And whether it's teach you something or just remind you of something, probably, that we're all adults, you know, I do remind Lorian to write. And she reminds me it's okay and to laugh and not get so dramatic. Or to not bake and go work on your presentation. See? Just because we have a theme. We have a theme going.
Oh,
this is why it's
so grateful. I'm so grateful for that call out. And Meg, I'm going to throw it to you, Lorian, but it's such a beautiful example of a motivational challenge. There are people who would call me out for that in a way that doesn't feel empowering. But Meg, you have such a beautiful way of getting me excited to not bake mm-hmm. this Saturday so I can kick ass on this thing I need to do. So it's yeah. I'm thanking you. You're right. And I will have a proposal for next week.
Good. And by the way, the following weekend when you do bake, I would like a delivery of bread.
I don't know if you do. Bread. I don't know if you do. I'm just saying. I'm a better bread. Writer than baker. So.
Well, I was just going to say that, Meg, you always have such a beautiful way of tying our topics back to the screenwriting life, right? There's the living as a screenwriter, and then there's writing, right? And I think the peopling perspective is really brings that point really home, right? There's the people we surround ourselves with, and then there's the people that we surround our characters with. And, yeah, the writing life and writing. There it is.
One more thing I want to say quickly, if I can.
Okay, go ahead, yeah.
A lot of you guys, writers, without overgeneralizing, some of you are very extroverted, and I know some of you are introverted, and that's why you love mm-hmm. writing. And you may be listening to this without a community right now, and it can be tempting, I think, especially as an introverted writer, to not create your squad or not create your people because you're comfortable in your room writing these beautiful stories that you actually don't want people to see. But I want to encourage you that you need it. You can't succeed as a writer without it. And believe it or not, you're going to find that those people who actually really are beautifully validating and challenging and enhancing what you're doing already. And it's a scary step to take, but when you find your people, it makes the journey so much better and greater, and it makes it so much more rich. So,
if you are an introvert, you don't have to have 5-10 people. Mm-hmm. You could have 2, mm-hmm. right? And you probably do have them, and you maybe aren't seeing them, or you're not thinking of them that way, or you have one, and okay, how do you get another one? Well, if you have one, you know, like some of my people I met because a friend, or my friend Jonathan, who was on the show, I met his wife, Hillary. Like, mm-hmm. literally, we just went out for dinner, and she's so cool, and at the time, she was a journalist, and I was just like, oh my god, I have to know this person. Like, I have to know inside her head, I have to know everything about her. And so I was like, you want to go out to dinner, just you and me? And she was like, sure! And, you know, so she's, like, now one of my people, mm-hmm. And Jonathan is, too, but we actually have separate relationships, right? They are different, too. We have couple relationships, we have separate relationships, so you can reach out through, if you found one person, they're going to have, like, it is like a branching tree. So I totally do respect introverts, and I do, it doesn't have to be giant. It can be just, if it makes you more comfortable, do it on our Facebook group. You know, it's okay. Like, we are here, we can be your squad, but I think it is better for people to know you more intimately, and support you that way.
And Sarah from our Facebook group, I was going to share this last week, but it's beautifully timed. She had sent me a really great note based on that table read I sent, and I was very thankful and said, thank you so much for this note. It's so spot on. And then she said, immediately following your read, I had my first Zoom call with 2 other women screenwriters that I met in the Facebook group. We're starting a weekly support group, and I'm super psyched to get started. Just wanted you to know that it's merely one of the great things that has sprouted from your, Meg, and Lorian's inspirational work. So,
hurrah!
Thank you,
that's
Sarah.
So yeah. Awesome. I love that so much, you guys. I love that you're finding each other mm-hmm. and connecting.
Do we have time for question, or should we
do we already answer a few in our chitty chat?
I'm okay. I'm fine if you guys have time.
Okay.
I can answer the question. Can you answer it, Lauren?
Sure.
Do you have time?
Sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Let's do it.
Okay. All right. So let's move on to the question of the week, which Elizabeth asked us two questions, but I think we can do both because the first one's pretty quick. They're both pretty quick. One is, could you please explain the different titles regarding story? So story department, story supervisor, script supervisor, story producer. I think a lot of, there's three pockets. One is live action. One is animation. Actually, there's reality TV as well. And then there's also different countries term different things. Like in Australia, they use a lot about the script, the story editor, right? Like you're a script editor or a story editor in Australia means basically you're doing development, right? You're a consultant, mm-hmm. you're quote unquote editing in the story section of the process. I don't think we use that as much in America. It's not a term I've heard in America. What do you think, Lorian, in terms of the story editor?
I think I've heard it in some TV. There's some TV titles that are story editor that I think they mean like we should ask a TV person this, but.
We'll ask our TV person when she comes on.
But it is a title I've seen in TV. Right. In animation, and then mostly.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. And then in animation, there's a thing called a story department, which I know can be confusing to people looking from the outside in, because a story department is actually artists. It's not like a room of writers. It's a room of artists who are drawing the movie in storyboard. So not animating, but storyboarding it. And in that story department, there can be a head of story or a story supervisor. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's really a separate thing, right?
Yes.
And then a script supervisor is live action, which is really overseeing continuity on set, wardrobe, props, set dressing, makeup, actions of the actors. You know, those are the script supervisors, which really is not about the story at all. It's about continuity.
But a script supervisor in an animated feature is about continuity, but story continuity, but tracking the script as it iterates and dialogue recording and making sure that all the dialogue is recorded in the different versions and tracking takes that the director likes through multiple departments. So it is a completely different job than in live action.
Yeah, and it's a huge job, I have to say. I was always stunned and impressed by the script supervisors and animation, just amazing. And then a story producer, my understanding is really a reality TV title. You're really finding the story in the reality TV footage. You're writing reality TV, which I know a lot of people don't realize that's what's happening. But there are whole jobs where writers go in and help write from footage. I actually know, who will remain nameless, a famous, very famous indie writer-director, an auteur, who has made her living a little bit writing reality TV shows.
Awesome.
Because, you know, everybody's got to eat.
Yes.
I was like, oh, my God. When I was thinking about that, preparing for this question, I was like, oh, my God, I have to write that TV show series. Like, that's like a great double life, right? Talk about a double life, right? And not a double life at all, because she's so cool. She probably doesn't care. So those are the different story titles. And then the other question she had is, if your script is optioned and rewritten, how are credits determined? If you don't want to be rewritten, do you have to be a producer on your project? And I thought this was a really good question because I think a lot of young writers can be confused about this. And of course, totally get that you would have the desire to not be rewritten. So in terms of the how do I not get rewritten, I have the thing to say is, did you cash the check? Because as soon as you cash the check, you've handed ownership over to the person who bought it, even if it's just an option, mm-hmm. right? So they can rewrite you if they want to, because they now own the concept and there's not a dang thing you can do about it. And I guess if you were a producer on it, you would have more chance to argue why you should not be replaced. But the truth is, that's why they don't like a lot of writers to be producers on their projects, because they don't want to get into this conversation because they feel it needs a rewrite. And, you know, you have to think about, why would somebody want to rewrite you? And I've been in the position myself personally, and I've known other writers I know a writer who literally was like, can you just go get another writer? Because he really didn't get what they wanted. He just couldn't. It wasn't like some kind of artistic, you know, you've ruined my world. He literally was like, it totally makes sense what you want. It's not me. I don't know how to do that. That's not, like, you should go do that. You bought it. Good. But it's not me. You know, writers can get written out. And of course, we don't want to. And I hope every producer and executive will hang in with a writer. They don't generally. I mean, I literally was in a situation with a studio where when I was a beginning writer, where I turned in a draft and I misunderstood the tone they wanted. Because did I tell this story where they said, you write such real emotion and real people. And so make this real. And so they handed me an adaptation of a movie. And I was like, great. And I made it real. And my manager was like, yeah, this feels real. It was still fun and funny, but it was real. Mm-hmm. And literally the response from the studio was, because it was a two-step deal, but one was precluded upon the other. And they literally were like, what is this? Like, this is real. And I was like, isn't that what you asked for? And my friend Chris was like, Meg, this is this giant studio. To them, Bridesmaids is real. Like, you have to know what real means to this buyer. And I was like, oh my God, you're totally right. I totally missed the tone. And they didn't give me notes. It literally was like, okay, bye, done. You didn't get it. That's not what we want. But I'm a bit of a dog with a bone. So I literally was like, I sat in a room with my husband and we were like, okay, if this is the tone, and we just started spitballing how to completely 100% redo the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And then I called up my manager and I was like, call them because this is what you say. You know what? You are going to, my deal right now for the second draft is $1.50. Like, it's so cheap. I'm going to come in and pitch a whole new version and you can pay me that $1.50 to write it. Because I was a young writer. I needed to stay in the game. I needed to stay. And so I went in and I pitched. And in the room, they were like, that's it. That's what we want. We're initiating. Go. We love it. The producer was freaking out. Everybody was like, oh my God, we love it. And literally that day I came home and there was a message on my machine from Pixar who had read the two reel draft.
Ah, yeah.
And that's the sample that got me Inside Out.
Yeah.
So on one hand, I quote unquote made a mistake by writing my version of real and emotional comedy, which wasn't right for the studio. It just was not right. It's not what they did. It's not what they made. Right. But it was what Pixar makes.
Right.
So it's, again, that goes back to Beacon as well. Like, you don't know why taking this job and getting fired was going to help you on your Beacon, but it did. Right? You just don't know. And also, I should have gotten rewritten because that is not the job that they wanted, right? Like, you are getting rewritten is a bigger thing. Like, I understand that you think your script is this holy grail, has to be created as you wrote it. That is never, ever going to happen. There are hundreds of people who are going to come in and contribute to that. It is going to be handed to a director. And it is going to become their script. You, even if you don't get rewritten, you may not recognize it because the way they cast it, the way they design it, the way they edit it, right? It is going to hopefully be the inspiration and you're in there and it's your script, but it's still the director's. We are in a director's medium. So maybe instead of saying, do I have to be the producer? The answer is you have to be the director, right? So sorry, I always saw
being rewritten as a sort of rite of passage as a writer. Maybe it's my experience at Pixar where there's just like so many drafts and so many smart people contributing and participating. But I was asked to do a rewrite on a project a couple years ago. I did it, you know, and then a couple years later, two writers I really respect and like called me and they're like, oh, we saw that you worked on this movie. We're doing a rewrite of it. I'm like, oh, are you guys rewriting me? And they were like, yeah. I was excited. Like, I felt like I had joined some, like, club.
You did join the club.
I joined a club, like, getting fired, getting rewritten, right? Like, these are things that, like, every writer experiences. So for me, it felt like, and then, you know, right after that, I was brought onto another project to rewrite some other writers, right? Like, and I didn't feel like, I'm so fancy or smart about it. It was just like, this is where that, where they were on that project. They wanted a different point of view, you know? So.
And there is a trend too, that sometimes people will call even before they take the job. I was offered a rewrite once and I called the old writer, happened to be a friend of mine. And I did not take that job until I called him first and said, how are you feeling about it? Yeah. It's just going to break your heart, you know, that I'm, you know, and I was in a place that I could say, well, then I'm just not going to do that job, you know, and he was great. He was like, no, please, please, please help that movie. So he was awesome. But so, you know, sometimes
that's where I was. They were like, how was it? I was like, here's how it was. I'm so excited you're doing this. Like, I didn't have any attachment to what I'd written in a real way that felt like these people were betraying me at all. I was like, good. I hope this turns out great for everybody. Right. Like, yeah.
I can see how it gets confusing, especially for young writers. There's a difference, right, between this writing is almost like journaling. It's your heart, it's your soul, it's your art, versus we're in a business. And and once it goes into the business, it is business, man. It is a product that now is going to go through some, it's got to hit some marks, right? Even if you got super lucky and the director and you were best friends or you were the director, you're going to go into an audience preview. Right? Like, it's not going to stop. So, you know, that it is a process of iteration and you will be iterated. It's going to be iterated and you should want it to be iterated, because if you've sold it to the right person and you had the conversation you needed to have about why they loved it and what they loved about it, right? You didn't just take a check. They got what you love about it. They will, as a producer, protect it through that process, right? It is going to iterate. It is going to iterate a lot. But it will still, in its soul, be what you wanted to put out into the world. And I think that's
credits. Credits are determined in the contract, right? Yes. Yeah.
Credits, if it depends. In live action, and then WGA determines credits. And, you know, the studio will put credits on a movie as they're moving towards doing a poster. And then it goes into arbitration, which is a whole conversation we can have. It's a giant conversation to have. In arbitration of the WGA, that determines final credit. It can happen that the people who are on the poster are not the final accredited writers because they printed the posters before the accreditation. But then, you know, what that's really about, honestly, is, you know, people have back ends. If you get credit, you get a bonus. So, people really take those very seriously, and you should in terms of arbitration. In animation, because it's not part of the Writers Guild, that is determined by the company. And there's danger in that, of course. If you're with a not great animation company, they, you know, the reason the WGA formed is because people were giving credits to their girlfriend who never wrote a word, right? So, you know, yes, of course, those are always a danger. But my experience in animation, especially at Pixar, is super, 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 super careful about that. And they do their own internal audit. They read there's somebody reading every script. And, you know, it's really taken very seriously and very well done. And that's how credit is done in animation. So, again, as a writer, can you control that? No, not really. Because if you're getting rewritten, now listen, here's a tricky thing. There are writers who I've heard about who know the percentage they have to change in order to get credit.
Yep.
And they will change just to get the credit. I think that's kind of sleazy, but I get it as well, because they're looking, you know, it's a back end, it's a fee. And boy, on some of these giant movies, it can be a lot of money. Again, I've heard of that. I've never met anybody who's done that. I've only met people who have gone through the rewriting process in a normal way where they're just trying to help the script. Often you can get, you know, literally some of these movies have had 12, 15 writers and one writer gets credit. You know, that's good for that one writer, but I don't think that's fair either, because 15 people contributed to that script. So we should have talked about that with Jonathan, dang. But so credit is, it's a big deal. And but you know, again, what you should be focused on, in my opinion, is writing the best scripts you can, and then they will go out into the world and hopefully get made and find their own way in the world. There, you know, you've done your sacred duty, and then it needs to go and fly and be what it is and go out into the world. All right, so that's it. That's our podcast. Thanks you guys so much for being with us again. Please go to the Facebook group. Go to the Gmail account if you have a question. But you know, I'd love for you to ask the questions on the group, right? Because then everybody can partake in the answer. But if you really feel it needs to be private, you can go to the Gmail.
So keep giving us feedback. And when you request access to the Facebook group, make sure you answer the two questions. Or we can't let you in because then I think you're a bot and I say no. So keep checking us out and keep writing.
Okay.
Thanks for tuning in to The Screenwriting Life. We love our community and we want to get to know you even better. Join our Facebook group at facebook.com/thescreenwritinglife or email us at thescreenwritinglife@gmail.com to have your question considered for the show. You can also suggest topics by emailing us there. Also, we'd love for you to drop us a review on Apple Podcasts. Even if we don't read your review on air, trust me, we have read it, and not only does it mean the world to us, but it helps other people find the show. We've always been driven by mission and mentorship, and reviewing our show helps expand that mission. And of course, until next Sunday, happy writing.